every generation, there are 10 or 12 men who, by virtue of the prophetic timber of their work, set the baselines and to some extent become themselves symbols for the theological discussion of the period. Our speaker today is certainly one of these. His work is pretty well known, I think, to this group. He served a distinguished pastorate in Detroit many years ago, has been professor of Christian ethics and philosophy of religion at Union Theological Seminary for many years. I think we all are familiar with his Gifford lecture on the nature and destiny of man. I think the two works which commended him to this colloquium in particular were one, The Self and the Dramas of History, and two, the volume called Faith and History. It was with these in mind that we asked him to talk to us on the dramatic view or interpretation of history. And it is a great honor indeed to be permitted to present to this group Dr. Reinhold Niebuhr.
Dean Alpert and friends, I hope you'll pardon me if I sit during this discussion. I want to address myself to the question of how religions and philosophies, if we will, answer the two questions, what does life mean and what does history mean? They are related, of course, but they're not the same questions. And I would like to put the answers to these questions into two general categories. The categories of religion, which answer this question in terms that require dramatic, symbolic forms for the expression of meaning, and the ontological phase, which answer this question in metaphysical forms, in ontological terms. Ontology, of course, means the science of being, and when you're dealing with being, everything is ontology. Nevertheless, ontology, in the strict sense of the word, is science of being, which means that it deals with essential structures, essences and potencies which become elaborated. Now, quite obviously, any ontology can't deal really with history, because it can deal with nature. It thinks it can deal with history, but history elaborates forms upon forms, configurations upon configurations, patterns upon patterns. How can you make this mean anything? Now, in answer to the question of meaning, the biblical faith, both Judaism and Christianity, have these dramatic symbolic expressions of meaning. They are called religions of history and revelation of history because they take the whole drama of history seriously, of revelation because they think there's an ultimate clue. They apprehend an ultimate clue to the mystery and meaning. Interesting combination of mystery and meaning in the whole of the Bible. It's a question whether there are only the two biblical faiths that do this. Archbishop Soderblom and Oman, in his rather good book written years ago, The Natural and Supernatural, says that Zoroastrianism and Islam belong to this category of historical religions. And I think that's quite true. Islam, I would say, we don't have to deal with that particularly because it is a corrupted form of a religion of history and revelation. Corrupted because it has a simple identification between the divine and the human, so that this religion becomes the basis of Islamic imperialism. It's significant that it had this great success at the beginning and is now moribund. Both things are significant, its success and its failure, because it had two simple categories of meaning, of coordination between the divine and the human. Zoroastrianism is not a particularly live option, so I might consider that, except to think that I think Archbishop Soderblom is right in saying you have to include Zoroastrianism. What we're dealing with is the two biblical faiths. How do they give meaning to life and to history? They do it by looking at the whole drama of history and finding in this drama various points of revelation, the mighty acts of God, and then a supreme point of revelation, which is the linchpin of the structure of meaning. For the Old Testament, that is the covenant, or let us say the covenant and the Messianic age. Here I follow Kuhlman in his Christus und die Zeit and say the Old Testament and the New Testament are alike. In this they have a different, terminal points for history, but they have both a center and the two terminal points. The covenant is the center for the Old Testament, creation, and the Messianic age. Perhaps I'd better say a word about creation, because that is the basic mystery, which is the foundation of the structures of meaning. Chronologically, this is an afterthought for the prophets. You could say they brought the creation in. They emphasized the Creator God in order to emphasize the ultimacy of the Yahweh, who had this covenant with Israel, that it wasn't the God that Israel dreamed up. It was the God, the Creator God. Chronologically, that would be true, but logically, psychologically, the mystery of creation is the basis for the whole structure of meaning. And you could say that both Old Testament and New Testament use symbolic, dramatic forms in order to express meaning in this mystery, beyond this mystery. So in the Old Testament, you have creation, the covenant, and the Messianic age. You would say the covenant and the Messianic age are the two points where the meaning of history points beyond history to the divine, to the ultimate. Now, from the Christian standpoint, this would be regarded as a not quite adequate answer to the problem of human existence. I don't want to engage in any polemics against Judaism. I think we ought to recognize that Judaism and Christianity are both biblical faiths, and that it may be right to say, as what's Buber's friend's name, Will?
Rosenzweig.
I'm sorry, I forget his name. Rosenzweig says that the two religions are concentric. They both worship the same God. But Christianity is for everybody, while the Jews have their Jewish faith. If you're going to have a philosophy of their relationship to one another, I think that would be more adequate than many of the other interpretations that's given. Nevertheless, from a Christian standpoint, this is a not adequate interpretation, because The Messianic Age is always something that is coming, so that the contradiction in life itself, and that is one of the problems of the meaning of life and of history, that there is this basic contradiction in human freedom, that we are not what we ought to be, that there is, as it were, a fall, that there has been a fall, which is incidentally also one of the historic symbolic frames of meaning, which you can't digest in any ontological system. So, as Buber says, the difference between Christianity and Judaism is that for the Jew, for the Christian, the Jew is a stubborn fellow who is always waiting for the Messiah in an unredeemed world. And for the Jew, the Christian is a heedless fellow who in an unredeemed world declares that redemption has somehow or other taken place. This is, I think, a very good definition of the difference. Now, for Buber, this doesn't spell the superiority of Christianity over Judaism. For me, the essence of the Christian truth is just in the way that Christianity declares that in an unredeemed world, redemption has somehow or other taken place. In other words, the linchpin of meaning is the Christ. That the Messiah, who was expected, when he did come, was not the triumphant Messiah who overcame all evil, but he suffered evil. And he became at the one and the same time the revelation of the ultimate possibilities of human existence, the agape, the mercy of God, the mercy, the love, which is the ultimate possibility of human freedom. And on the other hand, he became the revelation of a divine mercy which overcomes all the fragmentariness of human history, which always will remain fragmentary. There is no possibility of human righteousness ever bridging the hiatus between human virtue and the divine holiness. This is, for me, the truth of the gospel, which gives both history and life meaning. And I should say that one of the problems of Christian theology is to interpret this truth so that the essential character of it is not lost while relating it to ontology. This is what the Johannine literature tries to do. The Christ was the Logos. He was the Word, the Logos of God. The Word was, world was made by him. Without him was not anything made that hath been made. This was the pattern of existence. This is, the Johannine literature is the one place where in the scripture you have the wrestling between ontology and the dramatic forms, the dramatic historical forms of biblical faith, of New Testament faith. But when you say the Word was made flesh, then you're emphasizing the dramatic historical against the ontological. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. That is, this isn't to say that in the goodness, merely in the goodness of Jesus, as liberal Christianity used to say, we have a vision of the divine. Much more is involved in it. What is involved is the whole character of history, because this was the Messiah. This was the expected, the triumphant Messiah, who was expected to be triumphant over evil. Nevertheless, that's not what history is like. We know now that history is not like that. If this is what the Bible had said, it would not be true, because in an atomic age, we know that history moves inevitably toward greater freedom. which means greater creativity and greater evil. And there is no solution for the problem of history in history itself. This is what's true in the biblical eschatology, true in the symbol of the Christ and Antichrist, and the fact that Christ doesn't conquer the Antichrist in history. This is at the end of history. This represents the ultimate possibilities of meaning beyond the ordinary possibilities of history. So that when we try to interpret the meaning of Christ for history and for us, we're interpreting the ultimate possibilities and the impossibilities of history. The ultimate possibilities, this is, I think, the meaning of the two natures of Christ, which, when you digest it ontologically, as the Greek patristic did, you get all the trouble about whether Christ was human and divine, how much human, how much divine, human to here, to here, to here, to here, some human, some divine. They had to do this because the Greek ontological forms talked about the passible and impassible, what was passible, what was impassible. Well, obviously a character in history is absolutely historical. What we can say, I think we can say now, that he was human and divine in the sense, he was certainly historical, in that it was a character in history. He's divine in the sense that he gives us the clue to something that transcends history and bears history, the judgment and the mercies of God, which are related to the mystery of creation. And it's, I think, the task of every generation to rescue these symbols from meaninglessness, to get them meaningless, partly because symbolic dramatic forms become outdated, and partly because when we transfer them into ontological forms, they become obscured. So I think the task of theology is to hold desperately to the symbolic dramatic forms of faith as against ontological ways of expressing, but always to avoid the obscurantism that is involved in dramatic forms. Christian theology is always in danger of obscurantism because ontology deals with laws, consistencies, essences, which are disciplines of the human spirit, of the human mind. So we have the Old Testament and the New Testament faith both dealing with history, dealing with the meaning of history, finding the history of meaning, the history's meaning fragmentary, finding the nexus between history and the divine in a divine action and a divine judgment and mercy, all in this Christ. This is why this Christ event in the messianic context is regarded in the Christian faith, I think rightly, in Christian art and Christian piety, as the linchpin of the whole structure of meaning. Now, once we know this, this doesn't give us a simple explanation of all the patterns and the configurations of history. We can make a lot of mistakes about that. A Christian theologian can make as many mistakes as any philosopher of history can. As a matter of fact, you could say a priori that from a standpoint of Christian faith, philosophies of history are impossible. My friend Bill Herbert, I just wrote a brilliant review on Martin's philosophy of history. And he was very kind to Martin, but he called attention to Martin as a very great man. He's Goodwill should be kind to him, but he called attention to the fact that he couldn't quite comprehend history from a Thomistic Aristotelian standpoint. Aristotle regarded history as a part of nature, which brings me to the great alternatives of these biblical faiths, the ontological faiths. The great alternative to historical dramatic ways of comprehending is ontology. Now, I would like to divide the ontological phase into two categories, the classical ontologies and the modern post-Christian ontologies. The classical ontologies are primarily two: the mystic phase, which defined God in modern terms as the ground of being or as undifferentiated being. We could say the classical mystical faiths are the faith of Plotinus. And in the East, of course, Buddhism. They regard the temporal flux as itself evil, so that redemption means rising from temporal flux to eternity by a technique of introversion, that is, the self as subject, looking at itself as object, finds a self as object in the temporal flux. Therefore, this is exactly how Plotinus argues. Therefore, the self as subject is in somehow or other not in the temporal flux, so it indeterminately extricates itself from the temporal flux until it becomes internal. This is the philosophy of Buddhism in the East and the philosophy of Neoplatonism in the West. It's interesting that my friend Professor Tillich, who goes as far as anybody can in comprehending Christian symbols in ontological terms, also is inclined to regard God in one phase of his thought as the ground of being, as undifferentiated being, and talks about the God beyond all gods that have been revealed. This is Neoplatonism. But on the other hand, we happen to deal, we're not a mystic culture, and the West on the whole has not been particularly mystical, so what we have to deal with is particularly the rational ontologies, which define God not as undifferentiated being, but as a structure of being. And my friend Paul Tillich again ambivalents between defining God as undifferentiated being and the structure of being. And this is not an accident. This is in the logic of ontological expression about the divine. This is an ambivalence between Aristotle and Plotinus, the structure of being. Now, if God is the structure of being, as Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics says, it means that the ultimate is a form through which the temporal flux of life moves. The ultimate, and there's no difference between God and the structure of being. That is God, the structure of being, because the structure of being is eternal. That's why classicism could never comprehend history, really. It always tried to comprehend history as a part of nature, because both history and nature were subject to these forms, these essences. Now, you don't, in rational ontology, you don't flee history in the way that you do in mysticism, but you try, both as Plato and Aristotle tried, to press upon the stuff of nature, which includes historical nature, that is, the non-rational people in history. You try to press upon them the eternal forms. so that Aristotle's polis is determined by the politeia, that is the constitution, that is the rational form which the rational people press upon the polis, the city, and thereby they create it. Now, it's significant for the inadequacy of this way of dealing with history that Aristotle assumed the Greek city-state to be the final form. And there's a very ironic thing about this, because he had a very famous pupil by the name of Alexander, who was subsequently called Alexander the Great, who made nonsense of the Greek city-state by establishing the first empire of Western history. There had been empires in Eastern history, but the first empire of Western Eastern history. And though Aristotle was his tutor, he availed himself of Greek Stoicism in order to get a form for this universal empire. Greek Stoicism undoubtedly was more adequate than Aristotelianism in its equalitarianism, in its universalism, than Aristotelianism was. But Greek Stoicism had the same difficulty that all forms of classicism had. It tried to capture history ontologically. Therefore, for instance, Cicero, who was one of the great saints of Roman Stoicism, tried desperately to get the form of virtue by which this Roman state would prevail or be reborn, because it was in the process of decay. And this didn't avail. The Roman state was reborn under Augustus in quite different way than Cicero thought. Perhaps some of you know Charles Cochran's brilliant book on Christianity and classical culture, where he elaborates this whole failure of Roman Stoicism to come to terms with this curious combination of freedom and necessity in history that produces endless contingencies, endless contradictions of good and evil. Cicero thought it was simple to get a form which would exclude vice and encourage virtue, because there was a form of vice and virtue. But we know that there isn't a form for vice and for virtue, because it all depends upon in what historical context you're dealing with this. Certainly the parochialism of Aristotle was vice from the standpoint of the universalism of Stoicism. This is one of the complexities of history. So you have a classical ontology of the mystic and the rational variety. But more interesting are the post-Christian ontologies, which seek to comprehend some of the biblical truth in ontological forms. And perhaps among all of them, the most significant is Hegelianism and Marxism. And I put them together because they quite obviously are blood brothers. You could say that Karl Marx was the inheritor of French materialism, which he was, but Hegel was his real father. Hegelianism was embarrassed about the crudeness. Now, think of the significance of this. It was embarrassed about the crude picture thinking of biblical faith. That's what Hegel called it. Indeed, it's right to call it that in some context. And he was going to rationalize that, and he did. And in his rationalization, he made history itself into Christ. The dialectic of history was Christ. So he made a much more elaborate ontological frame which would take in history, where the classical ontologists didn't take in history. He thought he took in history, but I think that Hegel, despite of his massive achievement, and his achievement was very massive, has brought as much confusion in Western culture as any philosopher, because history doesn't move by this logic, dialectic, that he thought it moved by, that the thesis, synthesis, antithesis, synthesis, the dialectic of history. And when this didn't seem to make any sense, Marx thought it would make more sense on a materialistic level, and he interpreted this dialectic materialistically. And so we have both Hegelianism and Marxism. And Marxism is certainly the great religion, alternative religion for modern man. We're involved in a terrific struggle with a great world empire that is informed by the Marxist scientific religion. It's not called a religion, but it has a sense of the ultimate being, the ultimate that is in both Hegel and in Aristotle. God is a structure, the logic of history. And you conform everything to this structure. That's the only way that you can be pious, and that's the way the Marxist is pious. Meanwhile, you can do all kinds of damage to the actual structures of history, because history isn't as logical as Hegel or Marx thought it was. And this is always the problem. How can we find meaning in this thing when it isn't as logical as the ontologists say it is? It is not as logical as Aristotle or as the Stoics, or as Hegel, or as Marx said it was. History is illogical, and yet somehow other meaningful. We might mention just two more of the post-Christian ontologies, and that is evolutionary naturalism, which was the religion a bourgeois society until the World War. Such a powerful religion. I referred to social Darwinism, the idea of progress that you have in Spencer, to some degree in Comte, but mostly in Herbert Spencer, that, again, history is equated with nature. And the progress of history is identified with the evolutionary process of nature, moving things up to a universal community and so forth and so on. There's something deeply ironic in the way that has been refuted. This is one of the spiritual crises of our age, because there has been progress, but there was included in this progress something that Spencer or Comte or all these, or Hegel didn't anticipate, and it's progress in the weapons of warfare, from the spear to the hydrogen bomb. This is one of the deep tragedies of history, which must impress even the most stupid of the moderns, that there is no answer to the problem of history in history itself. Because history keeps on piling up the problems. It accentuates the problems. We ought to recognize that it accentuates. It's significant that there's been progress in the dimension of community, but not progress in universal community. So that we now face the ironic fact that the world is divided between two great communities, the so-called free world and the communist community. And this is our actual history, this contest, where we don't know whether we're going to destroy each other or have mutual destruction or not. This is the actual history. While meanwhile, the Western world, in as far as it has a consistent philosophy, and thank God it hasn't a consistent philosophy, it has a philosophy of secularism, various forms of Christianity, and on the whole, I think it's been a salvation of the Western world. The more I look at life, the more I value pluralism, because life is so full of antinomies that if you allow any group of scientists, philosophers, or priests to give you the exact meaning of the thing. They're going to misinterpret it, sure as everything. So the Western world has its pluralistic culture, but in as far as it has any sense of the meaning of history, it is the idea of progress. And the communists, well, we know their apocalyptic faith. And the situation in which they both stand has refuted what they each thought about the meaning of history. Now, we can't leave these alternative and ontologies without mentioning a third. I mean, post-Christian ontologies, which is more closely related to the Christian faith and has more context with the Christian faith than any of the Hegelianism or evolutionary naturalism. And I mean Kant's critical idealism. Because, and perhaps there it would be better not to speak about ontology and say philosophy, because the reason it is so comparatively creative is because it is a critical idealism, and it has a sense of a mystery beyond the realm of rational intelligibility, distinction in Kant between the noumenal and phenomenal world, the idea that practical reason, that is faith, has a sense of a transcendent meaning of life, God, freedom, and immortality, that goes beyond the intelligibilities of the phenomenal world, of the temporal world, let us say, of the temporal world. Now, on the basis of this kind of critical ideas, all kinds of bridges have been constructed between Christianity and philosophy, the whole post-Kantian development. I will mention only two to show that they are valuable and also that they have defects. The philosophy of Ernst Cassirer and the theology of Bultmann. This theologian and this philosopher are obviously informed by Kantian presuppositions. Let me take Bultmann first. Bultmann takes his Kantianism from Heidegger, and Heidegger has claims to be not an existentialist, but an ontologist primarily, who has the same Kantian idea of the phenomenal and the noumenal world, but he takes seriously what Kant didn't see at all, that the freedom of man is not merely the freedom of his mind over his body, the intelligible self as against the sensible self, but there's this ambiguous and incongruous freedom of the human person that transcends the flux, the sine sum tota, the going to death, and defies it. This is this incongruous, unified person, and this is where Heidegger and Bultmann are related to the Christian faith closer than Kant is, because the Bible always sees the person as a whole person, while purely ontological faiths always make this distinction between mind and body. The body belongs to the phenomenal world, to the sensible self, and the mind is the intelligent self. That's where Kant was just like the classicists. But Heidegger sees that the self is an incongruous creature who must defy death. An authentic existence for Heidegger is precisely this defiance, this rescuing of the self from anonymity, das Mann, anonymous existence, natural existence. Now notice, how Bultmann has been influenced by Heidegger, because Bultmann is, of course, a New Testament theologian and a very brilliant one, and he analyzes all the New Testament material, and he wants to rescue what he says is the kerygma, and he thinks that liberal Christianity didn't protect the kerygma, the good news of the gospel, against philosophy. He's going to rescue that. He's on the other hand going to get rid, and this I think is very laudable, the obscurantism of the historical symbol in Christian faith. As I said before, Christian historical faiths are always on the edge of obscurantism. They always produce Billy Grahams and fundamentalism. So he's going to cleanse our faith from the mythologies of a primitive pre-scientific culture. But he doesn't quite see that the whole framework of the Bible is, if you will, symbolic. That you can't say that Jesus is the Christ without uttering a myth or a symbol. I'd rather use the word symbol than myth, because myth from Plato has this subjectivist, skeptical connotation. But when you say that a character of history is not for me only a character of history but a clue to the divine mercy, then you're speaking mythically. So when you make an effort to demythologize the scriptures, you must pay close attention to the difference between a pre-scientific myth, which Bultmann wants to exclude, and a permanent myth. And I'd call the permanent myth not only the myth that Jesus is the Christ, but the fall of man, this curious self-contradiction in man, which comes out of a point of history, but nobody takes this point of history as history itself. I mean, the story of the Garden of Eden. And yet, the Times Literary Supplement last week had a very excellent editorial on a lecture that a Jewish professor by the name of Talman of Hebrew University. Well, you know the fellow we were talking about? Yeah. And this is rather interesting because Talman was giving a lecture at London, in which he said that if you didn't believe in original sin, you were bound to be a utopian, which is, I think, quite right. And the Times Literary Supplement said, this is the one doctrine of Christianity, the doctrine of the fall and of original sin, that is proved up to the hilt, so that you don't really have to bother to prove it. Nevertheless, this truth of this myth is involved in primitive myth about even the apple and so forth. We had a Catholic priest at our seminary in a summer school some time ago who told me the interesting story that he was bothered about the story of the fall, and he wrote to the Institute of Biblical Studies of the Vatican. And he asked, about this Garden of Eden, is this allegorical or is this historical? And he got the answer that it was allegorical. And he studied a little more, and the next year he wrote another letter, and he said, but what about the tree? Is that allegorical or historical? And they answered it was historical. It was allegorical. And so the priest said, I didn't know what to do with an allegorical tree in a historical garden. Now, even in Catholicism, in other words, you have difficulty about what I would call pre-scientific myths, which may be on the circumference of the permanent myths. the myth of creation, of the fall, of the redemption, and the eschatological myths. These are all the permanent myths where the human imagination tries to transcend itself, that is, transcend the categories of reason. Sometimes makes nonsense because it transcends them too much, but nevertheless touches the fringes of the eternal, where meaning and mystery are curiously intertwined. May I say just one more word about this permanent and myth and primitive myth, or pre-scientific myth, referring again to my esteemed colleague, Professor Tilley. Years ago, when he came to our country, he told me, I think quite rightly, that the mind of modern man was set against the idea of the fall and of original sin, and you would have to translate that in some way in order to get people to accept it. And this was provisionally right. I didn't follow him on this. I brazenly talked about the fall and about original sin, and the professors of philosophy at Harvard tore their hair and said that anything that I would say about politics was determined by primitive dogmatism and so forth. So Tillich was right. The mind of modern man is set against this kind of myth. Now Tillich translated the myth and said, in Platonic terms, the difference is between the essential man and the existential man. Now, when you translate the dramatic historical symbol into an ontological one like that, you lose something out of it. Because if you say the existential man is a sinner, then you're saying what Plato said, that there is a difference between essence and existence, and that all existence is, if you will, evil, by reason of its temporality. The very heart of the mystery of the corruption of freedom is lost in this ontological formulation of the permanent myth, which is the kernel in the shell of the primitive myth in the Bible. Now one could go on in all the categories of creation, fall, redemption, and eschatology, and it would be all the same thing. So, to make a long story short, our problem is not to guard all forms of symbolism against the discipline of intelligence. When you do that, leads to obscurantism. Our problem is, however, to guard the truths, the real truths, in these biblical symbols against the corrupt, the confusions that get into this translation from the dramatic symbol to the ontological one. Our problem too is not to divide the world as medieval Catholicism did and have one part of the world that you can deal with ontologically and another part that you would deal dramatically. That's the very basis of the medieval synthesis. That's not the problem, because the only thing that in us is ontological is the natural basis of us. People talk about the ontology of family life, for instance. I think that's nonsense, although there is an ontology of family life. The ontology of family life is simply heterosexuality. That's ontological. But everything above that is historical, is grace. Sin, grace, freedom, everything above that. Take any family existence. You can understand it in terms of the ordinary partner heterosexual partnership, but every family is quite unique. You have to have a good deal of biography in order to realize how these two people adjusted themselves to each other, and which takes a good deal of doing on the whole. And it's remarkable how successful it has often been. And you would say, well, the success, the fact that it is, broadly speaking, so successful, that must be ontological, because there's an element of necessity where you got a great deal of success. But nevertheless, it was successful in some ages and is not successful now. There's a much greater divorce rate. That means historical. There are historical hazards to the marriage relationship in a technical age, which weren't in an agrarian age. So there isn't much that is ontological in mankind except his natural base. And above that, there are endless historical possibilities and endless corruptions of historical possibilities. And there's a gospel that says, if you are conscious of these corruptions, there's always a possibility of a new chance. Because there's always, grace always has two facets, always forgiveness, it's always the power of the new life. These are the two facets of grace. Now, there is no ontology that will take care of the uniqueness of the person, of the unity of the person, of the uniqueness and contingencies of historical situation, of freedom, of sin, and of grace. This is the heart of the matter about dramatic symbols and ontological symbols. The fact that these ultimate insights of biblical faith can't be God taken care of in any ontology, modern or classical, does not mean that Christianity should flee away from or be guarded in its dialogue with all the disciplines of culture. Because while ontological forms are a danger to the Christian truth or the biblical truth, the disciplines of intelligence are not a danger. Without these disciplines, theology verges on obscurantism. Here I want to say a final word for what to me is a rather tragic conflict between these two old friends, Professor Bart and Professor Bultmann. Professor Gugart knows so much more about this. I hesitate to say this in his presence, but I'll say it, and if I'm wrong, he'll tell me so. Bultmann, as I first know him, was a disciple of Bart. And now they're at opposite ends of the theological spectrum. And I find this rather sad from the personal standpoint, but also from the standpoint of theological situation, because I think what is interesting theologically is that Bart isn't a fundamentalist, but the Epigoni are all fundamentalists. Bart is a very sophisticated analyst of biblical symbols and the truth in biblical symbols, and he guards the transcendence of God in these biblical symbols. But it's significant that the Epigoni turn out to be fundamentalists, because Bart thinks that there is no other discipline for the biblical faith except biblical faith itself, and has destroyed all the disciplines that